sometimes easier for us to see God in the big things we read about in the Bible than those small things, the routine aspects of what we think of as our daily life. We see God, for example, bring a global flood that we've been looking at in the morning, Sunday morning series. He rescued Noah's family by an ark. He brought the people of Israel out of Egypt through the Red Sea, but he brought them through on dry land and helped them escape the Egyptian troops. He brought them into the promised land that flowed with milk and honey. It already had the houses built. The fields were already tilled for them. That's what God can do. Daniel was preserved in the lion's den. They were not hungry that evening. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. He showed up 4 days late, they thought, but he's not really late. So we see God do these big things. We say, well, God must be in that. But what about the smaller things, the kinds of things that maybe we don't see as clearly, the everyday things in our own personal lives? Is God's providential hand at work in our homes? Is his providential hand at work in our marriages and our families? Those who don't trust Christ, who are not Christians, will almost certainly go about their daily routine and not think about God's place and what they do. But there's a lot of believers who might also live out most of their daily routine, and unless a big curveball is thrown at them, they get their tail in a crack and go and plead for God to help them with that. Absent that, sort of go around doing our business, getting work done, getting school done, getting everything done, and maybe doing it on the strength of our own resources, and practically speaking, we leave God out of it. The wisdom of the Bible is that we need to have God in the middle of everything, even the small things. We need a God-centric mindset. And I want us to look at the 127th Psalm. As you find Psalm 127, I'll read you something Paul would say in the New Testament about this issue, and this is Colossians 3:17 that I'll read. Whatsoever you do in word or deed, that's everything. Whatsoever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by him. That's the idea that the 127th Psalm captures, to put God in the middle of it all. And we find here in this psalm a psalm by Solomon. It's the only of the psalms that's attributed to Solomon. Now remember, David wrote so many psalms in the New Testament, it'll refer to the book of Psalms as David. You've read David, that means you've read the book of Psalms. Solomon, according to the scripture, wrote 1,005 songs. One of those we call the Song of Songs. This is a psalm, which is a song you sing as you would approach Jerusalem on a journey to celebrate one of the holy feasts. And it is written by Solomon. The primary focus is to give us wisdom, and I say that because this is what we might call a wisdom psalm, and that's consistent with his other writings that we have. He wrote most of the book of Proverbs, he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, and he wrote Song of Songs, which are all wisdom materials designed to impart to us skill in living, how to live God's way so that life will be better for us and to make good choices. And this psalm does the same thing. The primary focus is domestic activities, the building of a house, a family, a city, and a community. And the wisdom he has for us is that if we keep God at the center of all of our endeavors, if we give him the space to do his blessing rather than just relying on our own resources, and if we give him the glory for what he does, our construction project is going to turn out a lot better. The house we build is going to turn out a lot better. And I want you to look at this 127th Psalm, and we'll look at the very first verse, and it's kind of the first half of the verse I want to focus on for a moment, and I think it's something you may have heard before. It says, except, that except's real important. It means there's an alternative that's not as good. Except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. You know, Solomon doesn't deny that people have to build a house, a physical house where you would live. Doesn't just, you know, you can't plant a seed and then the next day the house done sprung up because it rained. It doesn't work that way. And he's not saying that, you know, you can sort of buy a lot and sort of sit around and wait for a while and God will bring out his hammer and his nails and start swinging the hammer and build a house for you. He's talking about something, though. He knows you're going to build the house or I'm going to build the house, but there's more than one way to get that house done. And so he's not denying that we have a role in this. But to say that God's the one building the house is not all an excuse for inactivity, lack of diligence, lack of hard work. And so this psalm could be misunderstood. It's not that at all. In fact, Solomon would elsewhere say, Proverbs chapter 6, he says, you can go look at an ant. Now, I don't know how big the brain of an ant is, but he's got more sense than some people I know. And he says, you can go look at an ant, thou sluggard, he says, Proverbs 6:6. Consider her ways. Just think about the ant, because God has programmed ants for survival and for biting our feet, right? Fire ants. Consider her ways and be wise. Those learn from it. Which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, nobody telling an ant what to do, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. And how long will you sleep, O sluggard? When will you arise out of thy sleep? You know, you can sleep through the planting season, and when it comes time for the harvest, you're going to go hungry. It's real simple. And the ant doesn't do that. And so all I'm saying is, yeah, God's going to build a house, but we recognize right off the bat that's not a statement about us being inactive and just sort of waiting for God to do that for us. But what Solomon does say, if the Lord's not in it, the building's in vain. That's a word he would frequently use, especially in Ecclesiastes, things that are vain or futile, they're empty. They come to nothing. They're meaningless because it's no use to God and it doesn't bring him any glory if he's not in it. You know, you can do a construction project of any sort and God can be in it, or it can be all about your own resources. And he's separating the two. One of those God's going to bless and the other he's not. So people of faith see God's hand in what they do, even small things. And they see the provision of God in it. They see the outcome as the blessing of God. And they don't think of themselves just, I built this house. I built this church. I built this whatever the project is. They see God's hand in building it, his hand of provision, his hand of blessing, his hand of guidance. They pray to him consistent with that. And when it's done, they say, look what you did, God, and they give him the glory. See, there's a whole different attitude when we see God as building the house. God builds the house when people build it by faith and the Lord's provision. They build it in accordance with his will. They build it in a way that's pleasing to him. It's honest, it's fair, it's right. And they build it and give him glory for the accomplishment. When it all comes together, those of faith say, look what God did. You know, there was this episode, a TV series that came on in the 70s and the early 80s called Little House on the Prairie. Some of you know about it. In this episode, there's a little church in Walnut Grove, and the children have gone out to Sunday school, and it's a church that's much, much smaller than ours, if you see it, just a small country church, about 20 people in it, and the pastor wants the church to get a bell. They don't have a bell. In the old days, churches always had bells, and they would ring it and call, summon people to worship, and so he mentions getting a bell, and there's a lady in the church. And she's got money because she owns the general store. And it's Mrs. Olson who gladly volunteers to donate the money for the bell and the plaque. Now, one of them poor farmers says, what do you mean, and the plaque? And she says, well, the plaque with our names on it. After all, we're paying for it, her and her husband. The farmer says, this is God's house. Listen to him. This is God's house. We built it with our own hands. And he won't appreciate putting somebody else's name on it. He kind of understood it. He knew he swung the hammer, but he knew God did the building. And he knew when it was done, it shouldn't have a plaque on it that had anybody's name but God's on it. That's the idea. You know, whose name are you putting on the project at the end of the day? Yours? Look what I did. What does it look like when God doesn't build a house? It's the result of self-reliance, pride, arrogance. It's based on one's own resources. It doesn't see God's hand of provision, and it's not likely to have God's blessing. Whatever blessing will be what you were able to do on your own. The problem is God has a better batting average than you do. It's really quite simple. And so it's going to be, he says, vain. It may have some temporal quality, but all that it could have been had God been in the project has been forfeited because we've done it in that way. What about what's in the house? You know, Solomon uses the words of a physical house, but I have to think he had a little more in mind. People usually live there. It's the building block of a family. They have a roof over their heads. And Solomon wants to see people who have a family that's blessed. No doubt he had more in mind, of course, than a physical house. And we have to say, well, how should we build a family? Well, this is another construction project for God to do. That's the real house I think he's much more concerned about. And he'll make that clear later in this psalm. He's concerned about building a family unit and when God will bless that. And he doesn't give us all the rules, all the guidance on how exactly to do that. That's elsewhere in the Bible, but he says you need to do it God's way. You need him in the middle of how you are building your house. And you realize when you think of it that way, this construction project never ends. It has phases. You're building a house and there's no children in it yet. And then there's a time when there's kids and maybe grandkids and a time when there's no kids. But you're about the business of building this house for as long as you're on this planet, and is God in it? There's a right way to build it. There's a right way to raise children, for example. In the scripture, and you know, we don't have time to go through all the things it says, but just as an easy example, Ephesians 6:4, Paul says, "Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." That word nurture is training. It's the word for like a child turned into a verb, paideia. It's the word for training a child up to maturity. This isn't just, because nurture captures some of it, but it's much more than that. It's all the shaping and molding of the child into who they should be. What's he say at the end of it? Of the Lord. See, and admonition, that's instruction, that's teaching. And I'm just saying the Bible gives us this, and it talks about the right way to raise children. And so Solomon doesn't go through it all in Psalm 127, but he's saying you need to build this construction project, you need to do it God's way. Well, how would God help me, you know, do this? How would he instruct me to raise a child? How would he instruct me to live within a marriage? The Bible talks on those things. It addresses them head on. So there is a right way to be a husband or be a wife. Just as another easy example, I read 1 Peter 3:7. He says, "Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them," in other words, with your wife, "according to knowledge." He says you need to understand her. Not understand someone else's wife, your wife. Understand her, "giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." There's a whole bunch of other verses that talk about the husbands, and a whole bunch of them talk about the wives. All I'm saying is God is in this construction project, and if I'm going to build it God's way, then I'm going to have to look at how God's blueprint says to build it. And he has a blueprint. And we see verses like that, and I just wanted to mention those as examples. But what about other ventures that we build? There's a house. There's a family that the house is a metaphor for, and then all other ventures in life where the same principle really ought to follow. James would say in James 4 and 13 through 16, he says to believers in a church in the first century, a group of churches, James says, "Go to now, you that say today or tomorrow we'll go into such a city and we'll continue there a year and we'll buy and sell and get gain." You know, he speaks to a Christian who has all these plans over the next year, all that they're going to do in their business to make money. There's nothing wrong with that. What he's asking is, are you making sure God's in the plan? And so he continues, "Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow." I know what I want to do tomorrow, but I don't know what God has planned tomorrow. That's what he says. And he says, "For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that." And so the idea, though, God's got to be in it. God's got to be in it, whatever the project is. What about our spiritual house? Our spiritual house. You know, Jesus would say to some people in the Sermon on the Mount, it's Matthew 7 and starting at verse 21, "Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of God." You say, wait a second. Well, maybe they just weren't doing anything for God. He says, "But he that doeth the will of my Father, which is in heaven, Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name have done wonderful works. And the answer is yes, they did. And he says, I will profess unto them, I never knew you. Ooh. They were builders, lots of builders, builders everywhere. God wasn't in it. Never knew God, didn't have him at the center of it. I never knew you, depart from me, he says. And so you see that. The spiritual house, what about building a church, right? What about building a church? You know, the passage here assumes everybody's busy, everybody's working, everybody's building, but there's a kind of building that gets built, and it's going to be blessed of God, and another that's not. And the difference isn't that one group's working and one's not. One's working with God at the center of it, and the other's just working. See, that's the difference he delineates. What happens? Look at the second half of that Psalm 127, verse 1. He says in the second half, except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. You know, ancient cities had walls. If you didn't have walls, someone's going to come and take your stuff. That's just how easy it is. And so they would have guards on the walls. And you could have a few guards or a lot of guards. And their job at night is to stay awake. If you ain't awake, you know, I mean, this isn't a new thing, or an old, just an old thing. This is a new thing. My dad would tell me about him having guard duty. The government, US of A, invited him to go to Vietnam in the 60s. And he had guard duty, right? That's what you do. And you want the guard to stay awake. It's very simple. And in Solomon says, even if the guard stays awake, it could be in vain. Why? God isn't in it. God isn't in it. And so he says, except the Lord keep the city. So you want on that corner, you might want a couple of tough guys up there, but you actually want God up there watching, saying, you know what? You ain't coming in here. And if that happens, you ain't coming in here. There's an episode of that in the Old Testament where 185,000 soldiers got outside Jerusalem and said, we're coming in. Just one guard up on the wall when all said and done, because that handful of Jewish guards up there wasn't going to stop them. But God was on the wall, and they didn't come in, right? That's the idea. You need God on the wall, and if you don't, it's all in vain. What's true of building a house is true of building a city, a community, a church. You know, Solomon doesn't say to be imprudent. He doesn't say don't post a guard. There are those who would try to sound pious. I'm not going to put any guards up there. I'm just trusting God. Are you going to put gas in your gas tank, get home, or are you just going to trust God to fill it for you? I mean, don't be a fool. A lot of people try to sound pious while being foolish. Put the guards up there and pray to God to guard the city. That's what he's saying. And that's how you put God in the middle of it. It's presumption not to. The point is, you can have all the watchmen that you can fit on that wall, and if God isn't in it, big trouble. He's the source of security. Say, what's an example of that? Jericho, guards all over the wall. God outside the wall. Wall falls down, Israel wins, right? It didn't matter how many guards were on the walls of Jericho. God wasn't in that. He was in with a group outside the walls. So you need God in it. What's true of cities is true of nations. We have strong military, but we won't be able to defend our nation on the basis of a military. It'll be on the basis of God in it, right? It's just that simple. It's a basic scriptural principle. Verse 2 in Psalm 127, he says, it's vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. Now, he switches gears from a house and a city to talking about our work. Okay? People in the house work. They may be agrarian and have a farm, or maybe a ranch or some other trade. And this is a picture of a person who, as we would say proverbially, burns the candle at both ends. They get up early, they stay up late, and they got nothing to show for it. They eat the bread of sorrows. What's the sorrow? Always toiling, always worried about making ends meet, never enough, always a dollar short, all those things, and the solution is always the same. Get up a little earlier, work a little later, toil a little more, worry a little more, and what happens? Nothing. You end up with the same thing, the bread of sorrows, just enough to remind you how hard you worked and how little you got, and God isn't in it. And that's his picture here in that verse. All their toil is vain or futile because it's not increasing the provision, and by implication, it creates anxiety. It creates the problem for them. And what they get for their labors, the bread of sorrows. You know, one problem might be priorities. There's a passage in Haggai. It's a really nice passage. It's Haggai 1. Haggai is pretty close to your New Testament, before Zechariah and Malachi. Haggai is addressing the building of the temple. At a time in Israel's history, in the 500s BC, when they had come out of bondage, and some of them could return as they had, with Zerubbabel and some others, and they returned to Jerusalem, and God says, you ought to build my temple. And they get it started, and frankly, they stop pretty early on, and they start working on their own houses. And after they get their house built and they got a bass boat out there and they start getting the hot rod fixed up, someone says, well, you think we ought to work on God's house a little bit? Hot rod ain't done yet. That's how they're thinking. Listen to what God says in Haggai 1:4. Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses? Sealed houses means they've actually put some nice wood trim on the ceilings. You know, they didn't just patch a mud roof, some thatch or something up there. They've got nice, got some cedar planks up on the ceiling, right? They've got a nice built-in stove, got all that stuff set up. And God says, is it time for you to dwell in your sealed houses? And this house, he's talking about his temple, lies waste. Now, therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts. Now, listen to this carefully. One, he says, consider your ways. And he would say that to us today. Consider your ways. It's a priority thing, and this has a direct application of what we do about church. You know, we're about the business of being God's construction project here. We're to prioritize it ahead of some of our own plans. And he says, consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. It's exactly what Psalm 127 is talking about. Working it at both ends of the candle, and yet not seeing the bounty come that ought to have come from that amount of time, talent, and energy that's been thrown in it, because God's saying, look, I can stretch a dollar, and I can make it really, really small and make it hard on you. You've sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. That's bread of sorrows. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there's none warm. He that earneth wages to put into a bag with holes. It's pretty clear. They're never going to make ends meet, and God says, I'm not going to let you. I'm going to make sure it's never enough until you get your priorities straight. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Pretty clear passage. I want to suggest something else about this passage. You look at what he says in the rest of the verse, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. You know, the verse says there's someone who's just vainly doing work morning to night, and they're not seeing the results they expect. God gives the sleep. And you're saying, well, what's sleep got to do with the work? Because that person that's working morning and night ain't sleeping well. It's real simple. They're thinking about the next day of work, the next deadline. How am I going to make ends meet? It's not enough money to stretch. God gives the sleep. You understand the gift of God is not in having this stuff, but actually being able to enjoy it, which here is getting the sleep. So I'll read you something from Ecclesiastes 2:11. Because Solomon wrote this, and he wrote the psalm. And in Ecclesiastes, he deals at length with the whole issue of working and toiling and coming up empty. 2:11, then I looked, he says, on all the works that my hand had wrought. He looks at his work, what he's accomplished. And on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. He feels empty. He did, you know, men identify with their work, and to work and toil at length and then have a completely empty feeling when you see the result is vexation of spirit. He's talking about being depressed, being, you know, upset at what he sees. But when you go down to verse 22 of that chapter, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 2:22, for what hath man of all his labor? What does a man get from all his labor? And of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun. It's his question. Is that all you get? Just troubles? You skip over to verse 24, and he says, there's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This I also saw, and listen to this, that it, what? the enjoyment of the labor, the enjoyment of the produce of your work was from the hand of God. See, lots of people have stuff, and they're unhappy. And they're unhappy because of this last thing I read. That's what's from the hand of God. The ability to stop toiling and enjoy what's in front of you. And that's the gift of God. And the book of Ecclesiastes is about this, and they talk about it a lot. Ecclesiastes 3:13, he says also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It's the gift of God to be able to enjoy the fruit of your labor. Ecclesiastes 5:18, behold that which I have seen. It's good and comely for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. See? So, he thinks this is important. He says it over and over. And that's what Psalm 127 is saying. You can toil day and night and have nothing to enjoy of it, or have God in the middle of it, and he will give you sleep. You'll have contentness and security as you rest. And that's the idea. That's the idea there. The enjoyment or satisfaction of one's labor is seen in the ability to sleep, as opposed to lying awake, worrying, and not having what God would call peace. And Jesus says, I give you peace, not as the world giveth, I give you peace. And that's what we're seeing here in this psalm. Look in the next verse of the psalm, verse 3. Now, he's going to switch gears back to the house. The idea of a blessed house, especially in the ancient world, is it had to have a lot of kids. They connected having children as a sign of God's blessing. And for some practical reasons that he'll say here, but this is what he says in verse 3, Psalm 127. Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. A heritage means an inheritance of the Lord. And that's kind of an unusual word for us in a way, because we think of an inheritance as somebody passes away and we inherit something they've given in their will. But when that happens, we recognize that they have specifically done that for us. You specifically are going to get this specific thing I have, or this riches that I have. And there's an implication that you have a responsibility to now take over the care of it. And so people pass things along. And now God uses that imagery for him in entrusting to people as a blessing. Children, with the obligation of then the godly raising of that child, the care of that child. In that sense, the inheritance of God, the blessing of God, are in these children. Okay, and it's the picture he draws for us. And he gives the children to parents as a gift, and also as an entrustment of responsibility. And I'll add there as an aside, you all know this, but not everybody gets those children entrusted to them in the same way, right? Sometimes a husband and wife can produce a child of themselves by God's blessing. And sometimes children come into our life, we're a grandparent, we didn't think we're going to have another kid in the house, and there's a child there. And all I'm telling you is God can be in that. So just keep that in mind. There are a lot of ways where children get brought into our lives, and God entrust us to do right. Verse 4 says, as arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of the youth. That children of the youth means the children born to him while he's a young man. If you're a mighty man, a soldier, and you have that bow and that arrow, it's a very potent weapon, especially in a time in history when nobody had a 1911, right? Nobody had a Glock. Right? They had a bow. And if a mighty man had a bow and some arrows, he could defend himself. But there's going to be a time in his life, if you ever try shooting a longbow, take some body strength to do this and to pull that string back. There'll be a time in his life when he won't be able to do that anymore. He won't have the strength to defend himself. But all those young strapping boys he had in his youth that God blessed him with, and they become full-grown men, and they have their own children now, they'll protect him. Just as sure as that bow and those arrows, they'll provide him care and security in his older age. That's the picture of this. There's a reverse of that that's true as well. Those of us who have aging parents are obligated to do right by them, Jesus dealt with that pretty directly in the Gospels. You can't say, well, I gave all my money at church. I can't help you, Dad. Jesus says, we're going to have some words here about this. See, that's not right. But he pictures here the children caring for the father, and that way they're a blessing for him. Happy is the man, verse 5, happy is the man that his quiver is full of them. Well, your quiver holds all the arrows, right? And God blesses people in different ways, but the picture here is just he's got a whole passel of kids, and it's a sign of God's blessing. They shall not be ashamed. That word ashamed means like defeated or overcome. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. In the ancient cities, when you had a dispute or someone sued you, they wanted to take your land or something like that, it was decided in the city gate. The judges would sit there. This man will have a whole big clan of kids there that are adults who can stand up for the family's rights and make sure legally they're protected. That's the picture here. It's an unusual picture for us because we don't do it that way anymore. We have courthouses and you pay people to go. They didn't know how you did it back then. You showed up and you picked one of your sons to go speak for you maybe. And in that way, it would be a blessing. Well, the house God builds, the children are a blessing. And Solomon marks that out for us. I'll bring this to a close. We need to see God's providence in everything, and especially family life. If God's working in your life, you shall see it in those, I say smaller things, only in the sense, not that they're not important, but they're routine. They're the everyday things where we tend not to see it, because I didn't see him split the sea today for me. He didn't even split the traffic on I-45 getting over here, right? Now, candidly, I didn't ask. Right? Maybe I should have. But a guy used to, I had a teacher, and he'd always say every time he'd go to Walmart, he'd pray for a parking spot up close, and we all laughed, and he said, I never had to park out at the end of the lot, and I don't have to wait for a parking spot either. So don't make God small, but see him in these small and routine and everyday things. We're building our houses as long as we live, but who is the construction superintendent? If you put a plaque over your house to dedicate it, whose name are you putting as the architect and builder? The psalm tells us don't confuse being busy with having God in the midst of what you're doing while you're busy. And this applies to our service here at the church. And you can get very, very busy, but God always has to be in the middle of the busy for it to be productive. It's easy to be busy. You can be busy with God and you can just be plain busy, and that's vexatious, he says. We need to build all of our construction projects God's way, recognizing his provisions for it, celebrating the success he gives us, and giving him the credit for it. Thank you.